involves not getting discouraged, all right? So that's the kind of effort we're on to tonight, okay? And that was called giluk, if you remember, okay? It's a kind of a rare word, and giluk means thinking to yourself that all this bodhisattva stuff sounds very difficult, you know, and it just seems beyond me, and I don't think that I could do it. I'm not the kind of person who could do all that stuff. I don't have the spiritual power that all those holy beings had in the past, and I don't think I could ever do those great deeds that they describe other people doing, and I think I'll just cruise for a while, okay? And Master Shantideva, in the verses we're going to read tonight, he gives you tips about how to overcome that problem. And I think the most important thing we're going to talk about tonight is called Buddha nature. And there are a lot of, I like to call them Dharma rumors about Buddha nature. You know, people talk about Buddha nature. Like, everyone has a Buddha nature and you just have to uncover it. You know, it's like something hiding inside your intestines somewhere. And if you could just uncover it, everybody's a Buddha and you just don't know it. And if you uncovered it, you would find the Buddha nature. And that's a Dharma rumor. It's not correct. And we're going to talk about the real Buddha nature and why that Buddha nature helps you not to get discouraged in your practice. All right? But we'll start with an idea that Master Shantideva talks about of comparing the Bodhisattva's way of life to a king. Kings in ancient India were like presidents of the United States, and they had their armed forces. Like in the United States, Clinton has the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, and the Marines. And these are the four great armed forces in modern times. Back in India, 500 BC, it was, and we looked it up on the computer during lunch, me and Michael Scagnelli, right? And it was elephanteers, charioteers, what's the other one? Infantry and horse riders, okay? These were the four great armed forces in the old days. And Master Shantideva says, just like that, bodhisattvas, as they prepare, you know, as you start to get interested in living like a bodhisattva, or acting like a bodhisattva, you have to have four armies at your disposal. And I'll go through the four, okay? And then after we cover that, we'll go through Buddha nature. We're going to have a digression on Buddha nature. So we'll start at the top. Say, giluk, me. Giluk, me. Giluk means that feeling of being, what do you call it, discouraged. Thinking I could never do it, like low Dharma self-esteem. Okay, and thinking, oh, I could never act like those great people acted in the past. You know, I could never do what they do. I could never do the great deeds that bodhisattvas do. Me means you have to overcome that. Giluk, me means not having that feeling. And approaching your Dharma practice like that, the activities of a bodhisattva like that, is what it is called Goche Tsundu. Say Goche Tsundu. Goche Tsundu. Tsundu, if it was in Mongolia or Ladakh, what? Tsungurus, okay? What's it mean, Tsungurus? Effort, okay? We're on the effort chapter, and that's the Tibetan for effort. Gocha is a beautiful word. Gocha means armor, like, what do you call it? Plate. Mail, like chain mail or armor plate. And gocha is very useful. It appears often in the scriptures with the idea that if you have certain attitudes, if you have certain ideas in your mind like compassion, then it protects you. It's as if you had on some kind of spiritual armor or some psychic honor, armor that other things can't penetrate. And it's very often... For example, if you're doing a long-term retreat, that you would put on kocha. And kocha is, in that case, is like compassion. So because in a long retreat you might get often special obstacles, very bad obstacles, you put in your gocha in the morning, you know, and which means that you review your compassion and you think about compassion in the morning. And that's called kocha. And there are even in the higher teachings, in the secret teachings, there are special practices for putting on kocha. Kocha prevents the good thoughts that you have in yourself from leaking out. So it works from the inside too. And it also prevents outside influences like selfishness from coming from the outside. So that's the concept of Kocha. Kocha Tsundru in this chapter of the Bodhisattva Charavatara means not allowing yourself to get discouraged. Now it's easy to say, and then we have to go over how do you do it. Like if you've been teaching the patience chapter from Bodhisattva Charavatara for a couple of weeks, and you go to work for an hour and your boss screams at you and you immediately lose your temper, that could lead to gilu, you know. You could start saying, you know, I can't even put up with 5 minutes of my boss, you know. I mean, here I am teaching it and giving people all these ideas that from Master Shantideva, and then give me 5 minutes in the presence of you know, just a lousy boss, you know. And I already blow it. And then you feel like an hour later, you feel gilu. You feel like, I'm not making any progress. I'm not capable of doing this. And we're going to talk about that. So you have to put on armor. And armor has that dual effect. It prevents things from leaking out, whatever progress you've already made, from leaking out. And it prevents obstacles from coming in. And the main kocha throughout Buddhist scripture is compassion for other people. Okay. Say, Jorwe Tsundru. Jorwe Tsundru. Jorwa has a lot of meanings in Tibetan. Jorwa in Sanskrit, the root is like yoga, yog, yug, to join things together. The word yog comes from yog. You know, when you yoke two cows together or something like that on an ancient Indian card or something, it means to join them together. Jartsi, another spelling, means glue, Elmer's glue in Tibetan. So jar has all these meanings of gluing something or attaching something or applying something. Like Nelnjor, the Tibetan word for yogi, has that in it. It sometimes means engaged, to be engaged in something or to be working hard at something. So this kind of effort is called, I like to call it engaged effort. Okay. You know, I have a different translation because there's another one we're engaged to. We'll call it working effort. All right. Jorwa in this meaning, also when you divide in Tibetan between theory and practice, sometimes the practice is called Jorwa. So we'll call it working effort, all right? And we'll save engaged for another one. So working means, this is when you hear the word effort in English, what came into your mind before you heard the definition of effort. What's the definition of effort? Yeah, Tsungkang Gela Jorwa O. Very famous. Tsungkang Gela. Say Tsungkang Gela Jorwa O. Tsungkang Gela Jorwa O. In Buddhism, the word effort, as a perfection of a bodhisattva, means just to have a good time doing good things. You enjoy doing good things. You have a good time doing good things. When it comes time to meditate, or it comes time to do something for someone else, or it comes time to do a retreat, or it comes time to memorize your Tibetan, you just enjoy it. You just have a good time at it. And that's the real meaning of the perfection of effort. This Jorwe Tsundru is more what you thought of in your mind when I said effort at first, which means working hard. Okay? At what? At the two collections. Okay? We spoke about the two collections last class. The first three perfections relate to collecting enough good karma that you create what? A Buddha's body. Okay? And then the last two perfections, meditation and wisdom, relate to collecting enough good karma to have a Buddha's mind. And then effort sits in the middle at number four, and it applies to both. So the second kind of effort is to work hard at collecting those two collections. So that's really the kind of effort that you think of when I say effort. Like working hard at being a bodhisattva, working hard at the six perfections is called Jorwe Tsundru. It's arm force number two. He says bodhisattvas have to get all the four arm forces together. Say, Lur Langwa. Lur Langwa. Okay, Lur Langwa generally means, it's an unusual word, and it means to jump into something. Like, it's a word for like putting something into practice. Like jumping right into an activity. Like throwing yourself into something is what Lur Langwa means. Throwing yourself into something. In this context, in the Bodhisattva Charavatara, it has a very specific meaning, which is that whereas effort number two is getting interested in the six perfections and actually working hard at them, Lur Langwa means what is your mental state as you do them? You know, what is your... There's this thing of be here now And it's like that, you know. How much are you present and how much are you aware as you're undertaking the perfection of patience, for example? Like, I had Jorwe Tsundu, but I didn't have Hlo Langwa when my boss came in and screamed at me, which is why I went to work, you know. I was aware that I was trying to practice the perfections. I had my mind on practicing them, and I was trying to practice them, but I lost my Hlo Langwa. Hlo Langwa has two parts. Say, Tenpa, Shexin. Tenpa, Shexin. Those of you who studied the course on meditation, who took the whole course on meditation, Tenpa and Shexin are very important. Tenpa is like the ability to be present at any given moment. It's like remembering or recollecting. It's called recollection. Recollecting who you are. Who are you? I'm a prospective bodhisattva. I'm an attempted bodhisattva. You know, what are you trying to do? I'm trying to practice the six perfections. Where? In my office. When? When my boss comes in and screams at me. You know, and that's Tenpa. Tenpa is like all the time thinking, that's my career. That's what I'm here for. You know, they're giving me money to do this, but the real reason I'm here is to perfect the perfections, you know? I need other people, like my sweet boss, to bring out, to test me, you know? I need to be in contact with these people. And that's why I go to work, you know? And so I have to be there. And I need them. And remember that thing about, what is it called? Strategic, what do they call that? There's a word in business, anyway. Remember that thing where you're supposed to go to your enemy and say, strategic alliance, okay, and say, look, you be the person to be patient about, and I'll be the person practicing patience, and you try to get me irritated, okay? And you propose a strategic alliance with your enemy, you know, with someone that you don't like, and you go to them and say, let's make a deal, you know, we'll make this merger. My company's into mergers nowadays. We'll make a strategic alliance, you know. You provide the irritation, and I'll provide the patience. And together we'll get to Buddhahood, you know. And from the very first moment, I agreed that 50% of the credit should be given to you because you're making me patient. You're allowing me to develop patience. So Tenpa means that in the presence of these people, as you walk into your office and as you open the door and suddenly there's 20 people there, you're thinking, Tenpa, 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 you know, I'm practicing patience, I'm practicing patience, I'm practicing patience. That's why I'm here. There's a very famous story in Tibet of a guy that was meditating on the side of the road, and somebody else was walking down the road, and they saw this guy in deep meditation. They went up to him and they tapped him on the shoulder and they said, what are you doing? And he says, I'm meditating, you know, and he says, well, what are you meditating about? And he says, Supa Gom. Supa Gom means I'm meditating on patience, you know. And so the guy says, Gyakpaso, which is a bad word, okay? Gyakpaso means, excuse me, okay? It means eat shit, you know? And so the guy jumps up and he goes, you eat shit, you know? And, then he says, oh, practicing patience, right? It's a very famous Tibetan joke about the perfection of patience. Tenpa means, that guy didn't have Tenpa. Tenpa means, you have to recollect what you're doing. You have to keep in mind what you're doing. Okay, your main reason to be at work, your main reason to be around other people is that you can practice. But you have to keep your recollection of who you are and what you're doing. That's Tenpa. What is Shexin? How does it differ from Tenpa? Shexin is called awareness. And Shexin rings the bell when you start to lose it. Okay, that's the function of Shexin. Shexin goes off. Shexin is like, in Tibetan they call Sopa. Sopa means like a watchman or a front, what do you call it? Someone who stays on the very, very front lines and watches the enemy movements is called a, what's that? Yeah, like a sentry. And he's an alarm ringer. He's not supposed to fight. He's just supposed to set the bell off, you know. So Shexin should be, these two have to be in your mind simultaneously. Shexin has to be in the back of your mind. Tenpa is supposed to be remembering who you are and why you're there at work. And then Shexin is like ringing the bell if you start to lose it. And it says, wait. You said you were going to be practicing patience. And here you are getting mad at your boss. Do you know what you're doing? Are you aware of what you're doing at this moment? And Shexin goes off. And you have to develop these things. Shexin and Tenpa are two mental functions that with practice they can reach a very high level. And in a high bodhisattva, they are reacting within milliseconds. You know, as the anger, even as the anger starts to rise, then Seishin is ringing the alarm and Denpa is pulling you back to where you were. And that's the function of those two states of mind. That's the third armed force. I guess it's like the Marines or something, you know, or shock troops or whatever you call them. What do they call it? SWAT team or something. You know, like, they're like, they gotta move in first and they have to do their thing. They have to be ready to do their thing on a moment's notice. What do they call that? It's a special group that goes in, like within 20 minutes they can be in the air and fighting, you know. And that's Seishin and Denpa. That's Lurlung. Lurlung means to throw yourself into it. But that's the real meaning of number three. Say, Dangni, Wangja. Dangni, Ongja. Okay. Notice the ba changes to wa after da. Okay? Pronunciation wise. Dangni means me, myself. Okay? We had another dak before. What was that? Dak Sheriki Kebu. He was Tsowo's brother. And they lived in the realm of non-existence. Dak, yeah, like self-existent being. Okay? Who created the world and had time to create himself before that. And stuff like that. Okay? And who knows all things but never, whose mind never changes. Even as he knows different things. Okay? Dangni Wangja. Dangni means, in this case, Dangni means yourself, myself. Wangja is short for Wang Tu Chawa. Wang Tu Chawa means, it's a difficult word. I had a good translation. What is that? Self-command. Command of yourself. Command of yourself. And I'll explain it, okay? Command of yourself. Say, Lesu Runwa. Lesu Runwa. Le, in this case, means work. It's also the Tibetan word for karma. And still in Hindi or Gujarati, they say, kam karo, you know, what are you up to? What are you doing? Okay? Lesu Runwa means fit for work. Fit for work. Able to do work. Ready to do work. And this refers to a special condition of body and mind, okay? Where, for example, with the body, if you practice meditation enough and long enough, you can make your body sit still for 2, 3, 4 hours. That's called lesaruma. It means you're fit to do the action of meditation. And it means you have self-command over your body. You control your body. Your body doesn't push you around. You tell your body what to do. It's really telling your body what to do. And your body has to obey. Because lesaruma comes from practice, constant practice. But there comes a point where you can sit down on your meditation pillow and you tell your body, okay, you're going to sit there still. You're not going to blink an eye for the next hour or 2 hours. It's called lesaruma, okay, of body. So it means where you have command over your body. You control your body. You tell your body, you're going to sit perfectly still for the next 2 hours, and I don't want to see you move, okay? And when you get to that point, it's called lesaruma. That's half of number four. The mental half, lesaruma, means you tell your mind, and you're not going to think about your boss for the whole hour that we sit here, you know? You're not going to go to work once. You know, you're going to concentrate on what we're meditating. We're meditating about such and such a thing, my breath right now, okay? And you are not going to think about your boss, okay? And that's where you have self-command over your mind. That's called mental lesaruma. And you can tell your mind, I'm going to be in meditation for the next hour. You are not going to think about another thing. And then you have control over your mind. And that takes a lot of practice. Lesaruma takes practice. In the secret teachings, lesaruma refers to a special kind of retreat. Is it called a levu? Okay, and that's where that word comes from. All right, so that's lesaruma. That's the fourth armed force of a bodhisattva. Bodhisattvas have to have all four armies to work with. What? To fight. To fight who? The mental afflictions mainly. Okay, to fight themselves really. All right. So lesaruma mostly just takes practice. Okay, and you can get there. You reach that point. Before you can see emptiness directly, you have to reach this point where you have lesaruma. Okay? And I'll read you the root text and I'll just translate it on the fly, okay? Giluk medam punzo dang, florlan dangi wangja dang, daktan shendu nyamba dang, daktan shendu jewar gi. Giluk medam punzo dang means use your use your first two powers, okay, which we already had, the first two armed forces. Florilang Dan Dangni Wang Jia Dang, use the second two powers. Daktan Shendu Nyamba Dang, in order to reach a point where you can treat other people as you treat yourself, where you can actually treat them as equally to yourself, where your concern about them equals your concern about yourself. Daktan Shendu Jewar Gi, and where you're actually able to put others' interests before your own, where you exchange your self-interest with other interest, and you're able to turn the tables, and what they want becomes more important than what you want, and you're able to turn those two tables around. Okay, is Master Shantideva going to talk about that? Yes. In this chapter? No. It comes later. Very interestingly, it comes in the chapter on meditation. Okay, why does he devote most of the chapter on meditation to the art of reversing your own interests with your interest in other people's interests is something you have to think about. We're going to get to it during this course. It'll be later on in this course. But frankly, he doesn't mention anything specific about general meditation techniques in the chapter on meditation. It's mostly devoted to these two subjects. You know, how do you learn to think of others as much as you think of yourself? How do you learn to put others' interests above your own interests? And what's that got to do with meditation? But we'll do that later, okay? And when Gyaltsep Jay talks about this verse, he says, we'll get to that later, okay? So I'm saying the same thing. Okay, next verse. I just love this verse. We had to memorize it a long time ago. And I'll read it to you. Daki chanjub kala she gilupani micha te dita deshin shepani demba sumbe dende sum. Dangbu sharam bumadan, deshin simbu kangyur pa, dekyan tsumbe topgena, changjub topka lame top, dakta riki mirkela, pendan nubbe ngo shepe, changjub jupa matangna, daki changjub jimi top. Daki changjub kala she means, how could anybody like me ever reach Buddhahood? Okay? Gilupani michate, he says, Master Shantideva says, don't think like that. Don't have giluk like that. Okay, don't be discouraged like that. Don't ever allow yourself that kind of thought. Ditardeshin Shekpani, the Buddhas, those who have gone to Das or something like that, Tathagatas, Dembasumbe Dendisung, they cannot lie. And so they spoke the following truth. Okay, now he's going to quote a sutra called Laksang Shubedo. Laksang is the name of a person, and oftentimes the lectures of the Buddha were named after the person who asked the first question. You know, somebody will come up and start the whole exchange by asking a question. Oftentimes they are a tantric deity. Oftentimes they're puppets under the mental control of the Buddha, okay, as in the Heart Sutra. Okay, but this, in Sanskrit, just if you want to know, it's Subahu. And so it's the sutra requested by the person named Subahu. Ki Shupa means requested by, and Do means sutra. Okay? So the lines that Master Shantideva is about to say, and I'll translate them to you, they're not, what he wants to say is that I'm not making this up. This is from the Buddha. Okay? And it's, I like it. Drangbu Sharang Bungwadang. Drangbu means flies. Sharang means gnats. Flies and gnats. Okay. Bungwa means bees. Deshin Simbur Kangyurpa. Sumbu means worms. Okay. Dekyan Tsumbe Topke Na. If they put forward the thing called effort, even they, Chanjuk Toka Lame Top, they can achieve Buddhahood, which is so difficult to achieve. Okay. So he's claiming that bugs and worms can achieve Buddhahood if they try. And he's quoting the Buddha to prove it. Okay? So he says, what are you, here, Dr. Riki Mirkena, here you are, you've been born as a human being. So what are you doing getting discouraged? It's not right. If flies, fleas, gnats, bugs, worms, roaches can get enlightened, if they put that forth a little bit of effort, then who are you to get discouraged? Now, you're human. You can hear, you can feel, you can read things, you can go to Dharma class. You shouldn't get discouraged. Okay? You're much better off than them, and the Buddha, Denbasumbe Dendisung, who cannot lie, cannot tell a lie. Like, one of the things about a Buddha is they cannot tell a lie. If they wanted to tell a lie, they couldn't tell a lie. Okay? Because they said that, you have to believe it. Pendan nebe ngoshene, a human being can distinguish right from wrong, unlike a bug. So you got a much better chance than them, and the Buddha said they have a good chance. He said they definitely can achieve it. Okay? Chanju chupa matang na, if I don't give up acting like a bodhisattva, daki chanju chi mi top, how on earth could I fail to reach enlightenment? So he says, don't get discouraged. Okay? Now, to really appreciate this verse, I think you have to go into the idea of Buddha nature, and that's why I want to throw it in here. This is a subject in the Perfection of Wisdom. It's a very, very sweet subject. It comes from the first chapter of Maitreya's Abhisamankara. We spend 12 years on that book in the monastery. And it's a great subject. It's a really beautiful subject. Someday we should do it in depth. But it's, what is Buddha nature? Okay, so I'm going to go on a little digression to the Prajnaparamita literature and talk about Buddha nature. You hear people, I've heard very responsible people say, Buddha nature means there's this shining crystal thing inside of you. There's a Buddha inside of you already. And the only reason you can't be a Buddha is that you didn't uncover this Buddha yet. Okay? And it sounds kind of sexy, you know? It sounds nice. It'd be nice if that were the case, you know? Otherwise, it takes millions and millions of years to become a Buddha. But according to that theory, you could just kind of take a good bath or something, you know, and reveal this Buddha who's sitting there inside, you know? And it sounds like that. And it's not what Buddha nature means. So we're going to discuss what Buddha nature really means, because I think it's cool. And it proves the truth of what those who cannot lie said about becoming a Buddha, that you should not be discouraged. And by the time I finish this little digression on Buddha nature, I think you shouldn't... Every time you feel discouraged, you can think about your Buddha nature. You can think about what your Buddha nature really is, which is actually more exciting and more believable than that little guy sitting inside of you. Okay? There, you really do have a Buddha nature. And the existence of that Buddha nature makes it absolutely undoubtable, indubitable. It's for sure guaranteed that you will become a Buddha. You do have a Buddha nature. And I can demonstrate it to you tonight. And then whenever you get depressed about your Dharma practice and you think, I'm too stupid to ever learn all this stuff, or I can't even sit for 10 minutes after 20 years of trying, or you get discouraged, I get angry or I get desire right away when the object comes to me, I don't seem to be making any progress, you can think about your Buddha nature. And I can prove that you have a Buddha nature tonight. And then you can always pull out your Buddha nature and look at it and say, well, things are not so bad. You know, I do have a Buddha nature. I mean, and that proves that I have a guaranteed Buddhahood. You know, you do have a guaranteed Buddha. There's a part about you, there's something about you which guarantees that you must become enlightened. So that's kind of nice. And I think when you're feeling down, Dharma down, you can pull it out, you know, and you can look at it, okay? Say, Sangye Ki Rig. Sangye Ki Rig. In Sanskrit, it's commonly called Sugatagarbha. Okay, Sugatagarbha. Sangye means Buddhahood, enlightenment, total enlightenment. When I say Sangye or Buddha, I want you to stop thinking about some guy sitting under a tree in the Little Buddha movie. You know, stop. Don't think like that. I mean, when I say Buddha, you should think of two things. One is a mind which sees all things in the universe at once. I mean, that's to me the exciting part. You know, this mind that can see every object in the universe in a single moment and is filled with infinite love, infinite compassion. So imagine a mind like that. You know, could your mind become like that? Could your mind in its current condition, such as it is, you know, could it actually become omniscient and know all things at once, all objects in the universe, and then have this infinite compassion for those things? You know, total, pure love, filled with pure love, and then physically able to appear in any location in the universe simultaneously in whatever form is helpful to someone. Okay? I mean, think of Buddha like that. Forget this guy sitting under a tree. Forget the guy with a big bump on his head and these long ears and stuff. It's not very interesting to me personally, you know. But the idea that your mind could evolve into an all-knowing thing, all-loving thing, and then simultaneously, you have a body that can emanate as whatever people want. And it could be, you know, a sponsor for some Dharma activity. It could be the Dalai Lama. It could be your own Lama. It could be one of your Dharma friends who helps you, supports you. It could be your dog that gives you companionship. The scriptures even say that it could be an inanimate object like a bridge. It could be the sound of the waves at the ocean side that comfort you when you're feeling depressed. It could be the sound of the wind going through the trees, and then you get inspired to think of some Dharma thing. And all of these are very common ways in which a Buddha can emanate his or her body. And I just, when I think of Buddha, when you hear Buddha, think like that. Think about being able to do that spontaneously. They don't have any premeditation. That's called, what's it called? Like Senge. It's just totally spontaneous. They do not have the capacity of premeditation. A Buddha does not think, I have to get down to planet Earth and pretend to be the Atlantic Ocean today so that Michael Roach can sit at the beach and get inspired by the sound of the waves. You know, it just comes automatically. They just appear. And that's the quality of a Buddha. Okay. Sangeki Rik. Rik means seed in this meaning, or the nature. Rik normally means family or type, garba. But in this case, it means like a seed, a Buddha seed. And that's what you call Buddha nature. Okay, that's Buddha nature. That's the word that they translate as Buddha nature. Okay, you do have something inside you, which is Sangeki Rig. Okay, what's the definition of Buddha nature as it appears on your homework? Okay. And somebody should translate this. I mean, this should be one of your projects. You know, one of the translators here, maybe Andy, he wants to do something like this, right? I don't know. But this whole section on what Buddha nature really is, which is pretty rare to find, it's hard to find a little bit, a clear presentation, it would be really nice. It's about 10 pages or 20 pages something, maybe a little longer. Sangye Sugyurung. Su Gyurung. Sangye Su Gyurung. Definition of Buddha nature. Okay? Definition of Buddha nature. The classical scriptural definition of Buddha nature. Sangye means what? That omniscient mind connected to that incredible body. Okay? All right. Sangye Su means into. Su means into. Gyurung means anything which could turn into a Buddha. Okay? Anything which could turn into a Buddha is the definition of Buddha nature. Now, how many things are there around this room that are Sangye Sugyurung? How many things in this room could turn into a Buddha? But I'm talking about things which are not Buddhas now, which could turn into a Buddha, okay? Like a certain number of people in this room, and I don't know how many, could be Buddhas already. Very likely that there's a certain number in this room. I'm not talking about them. They already became Buddha. They're not Gyurung, they're Gyurtsar, which means they already became. But Gyurung means if certain things happened, this object could turn into a Buddha. You know, like is the chair Sangye Sugyurung? Is this machine Sangye Sugyurung? You know, we have to find how many things in this room are Sangye Sugyurung. And those are Buddha nature. Okay? Those are Buddha nature. And the most important one, there's three classical Buddha natures. The third one is rather obscure, so I'm not going to go into it. I'm going to talk about the two main ones. These are the two main Buddha natures. Okay? Say Rangshin, Nerik. Rangshin, Nerik. When you're debating, it's like Rangshin Nerik. Say Rangshin Nerik. Rangshin Nerik. Okay. This is to me the most important one. This is the ultimate one. This is the really important one. Rangshin here means innate, inborn, part of you already. This is probably the one they were talking about before the Dharma rumor started. Okay? Rangshin means exists in you by nature. Rangshin ne means it exists in you by nature. It's innate. It's part of you already. Okay? Rik means garba, the Buddha nature. It's the Buddha nature which is already within you. Okay? It's the Buddha nature which is already inborn or innate within you. Okay? As soon as you exist as a person, or a bug, or an amoeba, or anything with a mind, anything that is sentient, you already have Rangshin Nering. And that's probably, I guess, the one where the Dharma rumor started. Okay? But it's not exactly what you would guess. And I'm going to give the classical Tsenshi. Tsenshi means locus classicus. You know, what's the ultimate example of Rangshin Nering? You know, what is the best example that you could ever give in the universe for Rangshin Nering? And I like it. I think it's really cool. So this is the ultimate example, okay? I better start. It's so important. I'll start anew. Say, Kigen. Gawa, Gyuki, Sam, Dentong. Kigen, Gao, Gyuki, Sam, Dentong. The ultimate example for the innate Buddha nature. Okay? Ki means dog. Okay? Ki means dog. D-O-G. Dog.
Okay?
Kigen means an old dog. Okay, a mutt.
All right, Kigen.
Gao means in Tibetan it means a beard, but this means like an old scroungy mutt. Okay. Kigen Gao in Buddhist philosophy is a very common example when you want to shock somebody. You say Kigen Gao, you know, old scroungy mutt. Okay, old scroungy mutt. Kigen Gao. Very common in philosophy. Especially in debate ground, right? Because we like that kind of stuff. Kigen Gyo. Gyu means mental continuum. The stream of their mind over their lifetime. Kigen Gyo. Their persona. Okay? Their being. In their being. What? Gyugi Sem. Sem means what? Mind. Okay? The mind in their being. Meaning their mind. Okay? The mind of an old scroungy mutt. Okay? The mind of an old scroungy mutt. Dentong. Den means true existence, which means self-existence. And Tongba means what? Shunya. Okay? The emptiness. So to translate that whole phrase, the emptiness or the lack of self-existence in the mind, which exists in the person or in the being of an old scroungy mutt. To put it simply, the emptiness of an old scroungy mutt's mind. The emptiness of an old scroungy mutt's mind is the Tsenshi in scripture for the innate Buddha nature. Okay? The Buddha nature. Now what's that mean and what's that got to do with us? Okay? It means that even an old scroungy mutt has Buddha nature. Okay? What does that do for them? What does it mean? And I'm going to go into this a bit. I'm going to go into a bit of detail. And you will, within 5 minutes, understand what the real Buddha nature is of an old mutt. And we assume that if an old mutt can have one, we can have one, right? And bugs and worms, and then we're going to prove Master Shantideva's statement and the Buddha's statement, okay? And it's very important, okay? It's very important. What stops you right now from seeing your body as like an angel's body, you know? Right now, if you're like me and I don't know who you are. I know who I am, and I'm not an angel, okay? But what stops me from seeing my body as a being of light right now? You know, why do I have a body of flesh and bone and blood and cancer cells cooking up in there and etc., you know? Why am I forced to see my arm as freckles and hair and, you know, dandruff and mole and blood veins and to know wrinkled hand and to know that it will die, you know? Why am I forced to see that? Why am I seeing that instead of a Buddha's body, you know, like pure light and shining, beautiful, perfect light with no bones or guts or blood or anything, just pure, a pure body of light, you know? What's stopping me from that And to understand that, you have to understand that this arm is not self-existent. Okay? What does self-existent mean? Self-existent in this case would mean that this arm exists out there, away from me, you know, away from my mind. You know, if I didn't think of it, that mind would still be there the way it looks. And that the way that this arm looks does not depend on my mind. Okay? The way that this arm looks does not depend on how I think of it or how I perceive it. Okay? That's a self-existent arm. And that doesn't exist, and it never did exist, and it never will exist. Okay? What does a self-existent arm look like? If you're in Central Park, it was a self-existent dollar, right? It exists out there, independent of how I think of it. Okay? No matter what kind of mood I was in, that arm would always look the same. Okay? But if you think about it, there's no arm there. Okay? If you think carefully about it, all I really see with my eyes is some flesh color and some black color where the hairs are, some cylinder shape, and some curly shapes. So really, and you can believe it, and it's logical, all that the eye can detect, I got this bump here, you know, cylinder shape and certain colors. But the eye cannot see an arm. Okay? The eye can detect colors, and the eye can detect shapes, but it cannot decide that this is an arm. That's something that the mind must be doing. Okay? I mean, the eye is just recording colors and shapes. It doesn't make decisions about what this object is. The mind has to do that. That's the mind's job. The eye is just sending information to the mind. I see some flesh-colored cylinder with a bunch of curly black things and these big red things over there. These red circles there, and these lines across the back of the flat flesh-colored thing. And that's all it can say to the mind. And then the mind takes over at that point. And the mind starts to organize that stuff and decide, this is an arm, you know. And so it happens so fast and so naturally and so smoothly that you think your eye is seeing an arm. Your eye's not seeing an arm. If you think about it, your eye cannot see an arm. Your eye doesn't have a mind. Your eye is recording colors and shapes. It's sending that information to the brain, to the mind. And then the mind is interpreting it and saying, okay, based on the data you've given me, this must be an arm. I decide it's an arm. And really, this is the trick. When you look at your arm, you are really looking at a mental picture that you've made. Because there is no arm out there. There's just colors and shapes. There's just the orangish colors and cylindrical shapes. And so if you're seeing an arm, it must be a picture in your mind. Okay? It must be the mind organizing that data into a thing called arm. Arm. I like arm. Okay? The next question is that self-existent? Could the mind have made a different conclusion? Could the mind have seen something else? Could the mind have organized it in a different way? Of course. Okay? If I took an animal birth, if I took a real roach's birth, then my mind literally would organize the same data into the leg of a roach. I would be looking down at the leg of a roach. That's what an animal rebirth is. It's not moving to a different location. It's not moving to a different birth. It's a mental shift. It's just a shift in how the mind organizes the same colors and shapes. It's very interesting. It's really interesting. It doesn't take more than a shift of the mind to go to an animal realm. That's scary, and that's possible. And that's very plausible, that the mind could shift in a way that suddenly these colors are being organized into a bug's arm, an insect's leg. And I truly see it that way, and I believe it to be that way. And that's what it is to take an animal rebirth. Okay? You don't go somewhere. It's just a change in the shift of your mind. It's a shift in the way the mind organizes data. You can call it a rebirth if you want, but that's not what it is. It's a shift in the way the mind is organizing the same colors and shapes. That gets scary, because that sounds plausible. You know, that sounds possible that your mind could do that. How long would it take? 65 mental operations per finger snap. It could take place in any one of 65 milliseconds. Every second that passes on the clock, you could have shifted your mind. There were 65 opportunities for your mind to say, dead, reborn. You know, to see the arm as dead and then to see the arm as something else. Then that's called dying and taking a rebirth. Okay? But it's not that. It's a shift in the perceptions. Okay? Next question that comes up in people's mind is, if that shift, if that's all I'm doing, if my life consists of my mind organizing colors and shapes into certain mental images and me mistaking these mental images for objects that exist in the world, then could I voluntarily and willingly and purposely decide to have rather better mental images than I'm having now? Like, could I remove this mole here by not wishing to see it? By deciding that since it's all my own mind's organization of data, I will choose to organize it differently. And could I remove that mole just by deciding it? The answer is no. Try it. You know. By the way, you try it all the time at work when you try to get out of some situation that you don't like. You're doing it on a grander scale. You know, you are trying to decide that this thing should change. And it doesn't change because you decide that it should change. It doesn't happen. Okay, what makes things change is karma. What is karma really? Is it some like cosmic energy? No. It's mental impressions. It's mental impressions that are created by the moral content of what you do. Very interesting. If you serve others, these impressions are very sweet and powerful. If you hurt others, these impressions are very ugly and dangerous. So if I wanted this arm to change into a body of light, I would have to first, I'd have to step back a few years or days or months and put in some sweet impressions in my mind. And they take time to grow, they take time to flourish, and then they take over. And then whether you want to or not, you'll be forced to see that arm as a deity's arm, as an angel's arm. And that's how you get to heaven. It's interesting. You really can do it. What I'm saying is the potential is there because of the real nature of things. You know, because my arm is empty of any way of existing on its own, independent of my mind, or to put it the other way, because how my arm looks depends on how my mind organizes it under the influence of my past goodness or badness, okay? Because of that fact, I can become a Buddha. That makes it cool. Because of that fact, one day, if I do the right things, if I help other people, be compassionate to other people, I will actually be forced to see this arm as a deity's arm, as an angel's arm. And when I look down, you know, the rest will be that way too. You know, so the fact that my arm is empty of being an arm from its side, and the fact that it's coming from me, makes it possible for me to become a Buddha. And that's Buddha nature. And that's cool. And everybody has that. So don't be discouraged. You know, that's Master Shantideva saying. You have that nature. You know, that's the ultimate reality of your body and your mind. It is to be very fluid and plastic. It depends on your perceptions. That your emptiness of you is your Buddha nature. So Rangshin Neri is the emptiness of an old dog's mind. Okay? It's the fact that the mind could be seeing anything, depending on the moral content of your past. You know, have you been good to other people? And then despite yourself, you'd be forced to see these things as an angel. And that's how you get to heaven. And that's how you reach a Buddha paradise, if you want to call it that. Doesn't matter, really, what you call it. You know, but you'll be forced to go there. And it will be a shift in your mind. Because your mind is empty, you have a Buddha nature. That is the potential for you to become a Buddha. Your mind and your body will and can and must become a Buddha. Because it's empty. Because it doesn't have any nature of its own. And it wasn't a freckly, wrinkly, hairy thing from its side. It's coming from my mind. So the emptiness of my mind specifically is my Buddha nature. And that's cool. And that's logical. You know, and you can think about it. Master Shantideva is saying, train yourself in what Buddha nature is, and every time you think, oh gee, I couldn't do it. I could never do it. You know, I could never become a Buddha. I couldn't do all those things that those great bodhisattvas do. Just focus on your Buddha nature. You have it. And so do flies, gnats, bees, and worms, to quote that sutra. Okay? And you have it. And just take comfort in that sutra. Okay? And you have it. And just take comfort in it and take refuge in it. There's two kinds of refuge, by the way. One is where you take refuge. Refuge is what makes a Buddhist, right? It's what makes you a Buddhist, taking refuge. There's called causal refuge and result refuge. One is taking refuge, going for protection in all the Buddhas who already exist. But the other one is very interesting. It's taking refuge in you as a future Buddha. You know, you can take refuge in your own future Buddhahood. And if you understand Buddha nature, then it becomes plausible. I don't say you have to buy it 100%. But I'll give you the logical progression. This is very much what we do in debate ground in monastery. And you stop me if I say anything wrong. And then if nobody stops me, you have to buy the conclusion, okay? Can the eyeball see an arm? No. It can only detect colors and shapes. Okay? So what must be creating the armness? My mind. My mind is organizing those data into a thing called arm. Quiet. Okay? So that... Sorry. You're such a philosopher. Huh? I'm sorry, what? A very, very profound question. He says, where does the data itself come from? And I'll answer it very briefly, and then we gotta prove the rest, okay? When you shift your level, this is Michael Scagnelli's favorite question, okay? When you shift your level of focus, and you stop thinking about where did the arm come from, and now you're focusing on where did the colors and shapes come from, that organization of the thing into a patch of color is based on perceiving the left side of the color and the right side of the color and organizing that into a patch of color. And the mind is doing that because the eye cannot see a patch of color if you think about it. The mind can either see the left side of the color or the right side of the color. I mean, by the time your eye has gone to the right side, you've lost the left side. By the time your mind has gone to the left side, your mind has lost the right side. You cannot be seeing a patch of color. It's impossible. Again, your mind is synthesizing. And you can go infinitely down, and that's one of the ways to establish emptiness, okay? Anyway, so I'm looking at the arm. It's a mental thing. Is it a matter of choice? You know, could I have organized it differently? By choice, by will? You know, can you sit in the dentist's chair and decide to organize the pain differently? Try it. You know, I always say, find me this Buddhist, you know, and I'll put him out there in front of one of those crazy Pakistani taxi drivers, you know, and break his legs and his arms and come back and report to me if you could organize the pain differently by willpower. And it's not true. You cannot. You cannot. It's not by willpower. Something else is driving it. Okay? Something is forcing your mind to organize the arm in a certain way. Okay? And it doesn't have to be that way, because your arm can change. When you move your arm, it's changing. Something's changing. The arm's not changing. The perception is changing. What drives the changing perception? Your past deeds. Okay? That's the theory, okay? That's the proof of your Buddha nature. And you have to think about it. If that's true, if what I said is true, and there are no major objections, right? I mean, your mind might slow down or say, I'm a little tired tonight, could you slow that down or something? But in theory, at least, nothing I said is very objectionable. And in fact, it proves your Buddha nature. That is your Buddha nature. The capacity or the potential for enlightenment exists in each person's mind. It is the emptiness of your mind. And interestingly, Rangshin Nirik, which is only one of the two kinds of Buddha nature, it does not change. You take that all the way to Buddhahood. In fact, it's the only part of you that remains exactly the same when you become a Buddha. The emptiness of Brooke's mind at this moment is exactly the same content as the emptiness of Brooke the Buddha's mind later. Doesn't change. And that's why it's called innate, inborn, unchanging, natural Buddha nature. It's the one Buddha nature. It's the one thing about you. And it's the only thing about you that will still be the same when you become a Buddha. Okay? Is the fact that your mind could have been anything, really, depending on your perceptions. And that's the emptiness of your mind. And that's why an old mutt can become a Buddha, and so can you, because his mind is empty. His mind is emptiness. Okay? We'll take a few short questions, and I want to have a break, okay? Make sure it's relevant, and make sure it's clear. You know, she said, I can see why flesh color cylinder might change to something else similar, but how does flesh color change to black color? And how does nice cylindrical change to bony, more bony roach's arm? You know, the sense that it itself changes due to your own perceptions. You know, you stop seeing the left side as flesh color, you stop seeing the right side as flesh color. Like that. You go down one more level. I admit that you have to shift levels to catch that. Yeah. Okay. Make sure it's clear and loud. Bodhicitta is defined as Semke Pani, Shenden Chir, Yandak, Zobe, Chanju De. Okay. Maitreya said, Bodhicitta is the desire to reach enlightenment so you can help other people. That's a totally different thing. Okay, this is Buddha nature. Unfortunately, it's translated as Buddha mind sometimes. And it sounds like Buddha mind, bodhicitta. But really, mind in this case means a desire. And bodhi, the bodhi in bodhicitta means your own future Buddhahood. And citta means the desire to reach that Buddhahood so you can help other people. So people have translated it as bodhi mind, and it's a little dangerous. Yeah. Semke pani shenden chir yanda zobe chanju du. The definition of bodhicitta is the desire to reach enlightenment so that you can be of service to all sentient beings. And that's, desire is citta, and enlightenment is bodhi. And that, Maitreya said, it's hot. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, he said, does the emptiness of your mind depend on somebody else's perception? No. No. Its existence, in Buddhism, the proof for a thing's existence is to perceive it with a perception which is not faulty. So you could say that your own awareness of your mind confirms the existence of your mind, like that. But it doesn't necessarily depend on another person's perception of your mind. Yeah. One more question, then we'll stop for a break. Yeah. He said certain theories of perception in the West say that the mind can only perceive an object in a certain fixed number of ways. And how do you prove that the mind can see objects in an infinite number of ways? In Buddhism, you can do something. You can establish the truth of a thing by logic or by scriptural reference. You know, you can either quote an enlightened being, or you can do it by logic. Difficult things, you know. Easy things you can say, just look. You know, that's called lunsum tema. But you can establish the truth of a deep thing, a profound thing, either by using reasoning or using the words of a reputable being, an authority. And then you have to establish whether this being is an authority or not. And there's a whole process for that. You know, is the Buddha, can the Buddha lie? If not, then I can believe what he says, you know. So in Buddhism, we would establish it both ways. I think we wouldn't be satisfied to depend on one or the other. If you're speaking to a Western audience and you pull out Buddhist scripture and say, because the Buddha said so, it seems sort of like sophistry, you know, like proving what you want to prove by using the guy that you're going to prove, you know? So I'm not going to go that way. But there is a way, logically, to prove that the Buddha cannot lie. There is a logical way to establish the believability of an enlightened being. And it's cool, and you can accept it. And I don't have time to do it tonight. But the logical way, I think, and when you speak about logic, you can just refer to your personal experience. I mean, you're aware, especially in your medical practice, that of how many ways a single audience can perceive the same object, you know, in an almost infinite number of ways. If you take 50, 60 people or whatever, and you ask them how did they perceive a certain talk or a certain sentence or a certain event, like I was in Thailand when Tiananmen Square happened, and I was traveling on a 5-6 country tour in Asia. And I read the newspapers in 6 different countries. And it was amazing to see the six versions of what happened there. And they ranged from nothing happened to hundreds of thousands of people got killed, you know? And I didn't know what the truth was. It was very interesting. But what I mean to say is that even in your own experience, you know that there is no objective reality to a thing if you restrict yourself to the ways that the people in this room have perceived it. They can be totally different. The base reality is the same. They all agree that they saw a pen. But how did they see the pen as being useful, not useful, beneficial, not beneficial, nice, ugly, better than the blue pen, not better than the blue pen, you know, wish he would shut up, put it down so I could go get some cookies, you know, something like that. I mean, everyone is perceiving the pen in a much different way. That's just a short logical one, and then there's many other ones. Okay, so we'll take a break, okay? Come back in 10 minutes or so. First one was the innate or natural Buddha nature. And now we get to number two. And again, there are three, and I'm not going to go through number three. Say, Gengyur Kirik. Gengyur Kirik. Those of you who care, the N is coming from what? The prenasal on the third column letter, okay? Which follows the sound. Gengyur Kirik. And then you can pronounce it correctly, okay? Gengyur Kirik. Gyepa means, how did I translate it? The Buddha nature which requires development, okay? The Buddha nature which requires development. Scagnelli made that up at lunch too, okay? Gye means development. Gengyur means it is going to. Rik means Buddha nature. So as opposed to the Rangshin Nirik, as opposed to the innate Buddha nature, which didn't need any development because it was what? Emptiness itself. Emptiness can't get bigger, older, smaller, wider, deeper, shallower. Its content never changes. It is unchanging. Okay? It is the general lack of self-existence about the object that you're talking about. And it never gets more or less non-self-existent. Okay? I'll give an example. There's no two-headed purple elephant in this room. The lack of a two-headed purple elephant in this room never gets more or less of a lack. I mean, you either have a two-headed purple elephant in this room or you don't have a two-headed purple elephant in this room. And the lack or the absence of a two-headed purple elephant in this room is never more or less of that. It's just either is or not. You either bring one in here or there ain't one in here. I use an elephant because it's big enough to confirm easily. You don't have to look under the pews to check, okay? Why do I use a two-headed purple elephant? Because it is the perfect example in this case, because a self-existent thing could never exist, never did exist, never will exist, is not even close to existing, and you are constantly grasping to it. You know, you have never, since the day you were born, perceived an object without being influenced by believing that it's self-existent. You've never had a correct perception in your whole life. Your mind is constantly grasping to a mode of things that is as silly and as crazy, but much more harmful than believing that this room is full of two-headed purple elephants. Okay, and you got to think about that. You know, the thing that Madhyamika is denying, the object that we are saying doesn't exist, is crazy and never could have existed anyway. It's as silly as a two-headed purple elephant. Okay, the fact that your mind doesn't have that kind of two-headed purple elephant is its Buddha nature. It's the general absence of a self-existent thing about your mind that never could have been there anyway is its emptiness. And that you can take to the bank, meaning that will not change. The day you become a Buddha, it will still be just as empty, just as absent, just as non-existent as it is today. And that's why that nature doesn't change. That Buddha nature doesn't change. It doesn't get more or less empty or anything like that. This Buddha nature does change. Okay, and this refers to the Buddha nature within you, which will create the parts of your enlightened being which are changeable, which are changing. Okay, meaning your mind and your physical body. Okay, because how much of a Buddha did we take care of already? The ultimate development of the Rangshin Nirik, you know, the Buddha nature, the innate Buddha nature, only accounts for one piece of a finished Buddha, which is what? The emptiness of his mind. or her mind. Okay? That ain't much. We still got to have a mind and a body. I mean, something's got to be responsible for that. What is the Buddha nature within you which will create your Buddha body and your Buddha mind? Because all we took care of so far was the emptiness that your mind is going to have the day you become a Buddha. Okay? And this is certain mental elements and other elements within you that will become a Buddha. Do you have them now? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. I'll give you some examples from scripture. Okay? Gengyu Kirik. Okay? Buddha natures which have yet to be developed or which must be developed, as opposed to emptiness which don't need no developing because it's always going to be that way and always was that way. Okay? The scripture gives examples of persons and minds. Okay? Persons and minds. And I'll give an example. Minds. A bodhisattva's perception of emptiness is Gengyur Kirig. Is part of his Buddha nature. Okay? A bodhisattva's perception of emptiness is Buddha nature. Okay? Is it the emptiness of his mind? No. Is it his mind? Yes. It's part of his mind. And that mind, as it evolves, will turn into an enlightened mind. That's enlightened enough to call it Buddha nature. Okay? That's the first example in scripture. Okay? Another example of Gengyur Kirig is the compassion in the heart of a bodhisattva. Okay? Already a pretty advanced state of mind. It's advanced enough to say that this is going to turn into a Buddha's mind. Okay? This is something that's going to turn into a Buddha's mind. Okay? Considered advanced enough. Scripture gives two examples of people, personas that you could consider Buddha nature, Gengyur Kirig, which is to be developed. The first one is baby bodhisattvas. Baby bodhisattvas. I mean, people who have just reached bodhisattvahood, which is very, very advanced. Okay? But baby bodhisattvas, that person, is a Buddha nature. It's a kind of Buddha nature. Because that person will transform into a Buddha. Okay? And he gives one more example, which is a person who has just taken bodhisattva vows. Okay? That's cool. So lots of people in this room. I mean, we did it here, right? It was one of the coolest things we ever did here, I think. If you're that, then you have Buddha nature. You have that Buddha nature also, which is going to create the parts of a Buddha which are physical or mental. Okay? Or changing, let's say. Okay? Okay, let me see if I covered everything in the homework. I covered the emptiness of the mutt's mind. He gives one more example, which is the seed, that very subtle seed within a mutt's mind that could turn into a Buddhist mind, or could help it become a Buddhist mind. So I'm going to put that, because it's in the Tibetan, I mean, it's on your Tibetan homework, okay? Say, Kigen, Gyawa, Gyuki, Sakme, Semgi, Saban. Kigen, Gyawa, Gyuki, Sakme, Semgi, Saban. Kigen Gao means what? Old scroungy dog. Okay. Sorry, all you old scroungy dog. Gyu means in their being. Sakme means immaculate. Immaculate. Totally pure. Okay? Totally pure is Sakme. Sem means state of mind. And Saban means seed. So an example of Gengyur Kirig, the classical example in scripture for Gengyur Kirig, is the seed in an old scroungy mutt's mind for reaching the totally pure state of mind of a Buddha. Okay. Can you guys... I'll just read it to you in Tibetan and then I'll translate it for you. When they kanla la sopa, tangu dangni jikshen na, chidang yawa ma che par, Mombe dagni jigbar se, kalpa chewa tame du, nandan tumer chepe dang,
dan sek dan shengyo ki chanchu toba mingyuro. Unde kangla laso pa tanga daki jikshen na means, suppose you come up to me, meaning Master Shantideva, and you say, okay, I get all this stuff that you're talking about Buddha nature, and I understand that the next time I get depressed about my practice, which will probably be tonight, okay, I have a new claim to make, spiritual claim, okay? For the first time in my life, I actually fell so asleep in meditation that I fell over and hit my head on the ground, you know? and I did it, I achieved it this week, okay? honestly. So he says, okay, I understand that when that happens, you know, and you're like, feel really stupid because I made a big noise and I spread all the other monks heard it. I don't know if they did. But, you know, when you finally, you can sit there and say, okay, I hit my head on the ground meditating, but I do have Buddha nature, you know. I know that my mind, you know, I can look at the bump on my head, right, and understand that it's a perception, you know. You know, I do have Buddha nature, so I can feel better. But somebody, you know, as you're seeing, the Bodhisattva Charitara is almost like a debate. People keep coming back to Master Shantideva, and he says, yeah, but, okay, Kangla Lasopa means, I supposedly, if I'm going to be a real heavy-duty bodhisattva, I'm supposedly going to have to be able to stand there with a knife and cut off my arm and respectfully hand it to someone who's hungry for meat or something. You know, I'm supposed to be able to reach this level where I could reach into my eye socket and rip out my own eyeball and with great respect and love and honor, respectfully hand it to another person who needs an eyeball or who feels like having an eyeball. You know, I mean, supposedly I'm supposed to reach that point. Tanga daini jik. That scares me. That makes me nervous, you know, like, I don't think I could do that. Like, I'd be scared of thinking of doing those things. You know, I would get nervous thinking to do those things. Chidang yama machepar. Master Shantideva says, you have not, machepar means, you have failed to analyze this question very clearly. Okay? You're not thinking about what's very serious and what's not very serious. You are losing your priorities. Okay? When you say that you would be afraid to do something like that, you can't imagine the day when you could do that. Then you have a prioritization problem. Okay? Mongbe Dagni Jibase, you are the Mahatma of ignorance. Okay? something like that. I shouldn't say that. It's more like you are afraid out of ignorance, okay? And nothing more, he says. Jibase. Kalpa Chewa Tongmetu. Kalpa Chewa means for tens of millions of kalpas. And a kalpa is, you know, zillions of years. So for millions of years, Trungmedu, you have been born. You know, if this theory of the mind, I'll say it once, and I don't expect you to believe it right away, but if rebirth is nothing more than a shift in the mind, and if the mind itself is a substance which is completely different from the physical body, and can never be destroyed, which is plausible, and I don't say you have to buy it right now, then you have been all things to all people infinite number of times already. You know, I've been Miss America countless times, you know. Really, countless times, not just once, you know. Redhead, blonde, brunette, I've been everything. Countless times, you know. Countless, countless times, over and over and over again. Because time is infinite. And my mind is indestructible, so every variation is possible. Given infinite time, every variation is possible. I've been everything countless times. And so, actually, I've had my arms ripped off from, you know, I've had my body sliced open, I've had my head smashed to pieces, countless times in other realms, you know, in other worlds which we cannot see. You know, I have been there countless times. I've endured every kind of suffering. You know, people have smashed me, people have ripped my face off, people have torn my arms off. I've gone through this. If you accept what I said earlier today, tonight, it becomes very plausible that you have gone through that. I don't say you have to buy it now, But if you keep following that line of reasoning, and if you can't find any flaw with it, no serious flaw with it, then you have gone through this countless times. For what? You know, Master Shantideva says, for what? You wasted all those lives, you know? You, and even in this life, you're going to have yourself cut open by some high-paid surgeon, or you're going to get in a car accident, or you're going to get AIDS, or you're going to get some terrible sicknesses, you're going to have horrible things happen in your life. For what? You know, you've wasted your life. You know, you haven't done anything meaningful with your life. All you're doing is grubbing around for money to feed this body that's going to die anyway. So what have you done? And you're to say, oh, what have you done with your life? You know, what have you achieved with your life? And not only this life, but if you believe in past lives, you just basically wasted all those lives. In other words, you're going to go through that same suffering pointlessly. So why not go through it with a point? You know, if somebody wants your arm, give it to them. Because you're going to go through this anyway. You know, you're doomed anyway to go through this. You might as well, if you get an opportunity to make something meaningful out of it, go for it. You know, so don't have to be afraid. You know, if you can give away your job, give away all your money, you know, give away whatever makes you happiest, whatever possession you feel most attached to, the person that you love the most, you know, you're going to lose all this stuff anyway. So he says, go for it. You give it away. You know, at least you did something meaningful. Because the day that it's taken away from you by events, it's not your choice anymore. You don't get any good karma out of that, you know. To have lots of money and then have events rip it away from you, which they will. Much better to do something with it meaningful while you can. Even down to your body. You know, even down to the meat on your body. Life is going to steal it from you anyway. You know, the people in the hospital are going to rip it up and cut it up and sew it back up and fail, and you're going to die anyway. You might as well do something meaningful with it now. You know, and even if it means something painful, small pain, go for it. It's going to get hurt anyway. Okay? That's his argument. Next one. Daki chanju dubayi, dungyal dini tsuyate, sungu konglat nu selchir, numa tepe dungyashin. Memba kunkyan soche ki mide wai nemeche, dewe dungya mambo ta shomchir mide chungsocha. Daki chanju dupayi means he's on the same subject. Okay, in order to achieve Buddhahood, dungya dini tsuyate, the suffering you have to undertake if you get to be a heavy duty bodhisattva is tsuyu. Tsuyu means finite. Okay? I mean, there's a certain point where you can say, that's enough good karma, and now you can see yourself as a Buddha. You know? I mean, there's a certain point, there's a certain number that you can say, if you reach that many good deeds, that many good thoughts, that much compassion, your body will start to transform. And the people around you will start to transform. You know, there's a certain number you can put on it. Tsuyu means, you know, there's a limit. He says, that's cool. Compared to all the infinite suffering you've been up to now. Those sufferings were limitless. Those sufferings don't have a number. So you're going to suffer. But at least there's a, you know, like I don't like to be at work. I had to be at work the last 2 weeks. Tomorrow's going to be a cinch. Why? I know at 5 o'clock I don't have to go back for a month. You know? So to you know, the knowledge that there's a limit, the knowledge that there's an end, can do a lot for your effort. Just don't worry about doing hard things, because there's a point that you'll get to where it'll start to change. Then he says, you can take, for example, in the common everyday world, if you haven't, I've met people, I know people, who swore they would never have an operation. You know, they said, I will never let my body be cut open, you know. I will never let myself be, what do they call it? Like insulted by those nurses and doctors, you know. I forget what you call it, but what? My dignity will never be so besmirched to let them, you know, do their shtick on me. You know, like I refuse. When the day comes, I will refuse. You know, and then almost always they're the one that you hear about that's in the hospital. You know, and they got 24 tubes up them, and the doctors have done all these weird treatments to them. And you go in and say, weren't you the person who said you'd never do that? You know, and they said, yeah, but I was really hurting bad, you know, and I was dying, and I had to do it, you know. Yeah, you know. And he's saying that. He's saying there gets a point in every person's body where you get some kind of pain or trouble so serious that you submit yourself to the indignity and to the sufferings caused by a doctor. You know, there comes a point in every person's body, if you live long enough, that you will happily say, cut me open. And you will happily undergo that pain. Because you know the option. You know the only other choice is to die or something like that. So he uses that example. Master Shantideva says, you do put up with a physician cutting you open, creating purposely suffering for you because you know it will cure a much larger suffering. So what's the point? Don't be so wimpy. You know, if you have to undergo certain sufferings to get to Buddhahood, which is the big cure, you know, enlightenment is the ultimate cure, then what are you whining about? You know, just do it. Okay? If it takes like staying up late at night, you're not getting enough sleep, you know, things are not going the way you want, you have to not have as much career as other people have, you know, you don't have the possessions that other people have because you're spending time, you're wasting time meditating, right? He says, put up with it, you know. Bear a little pain for the big result. The Sakyapandita in his lecture, he says, this is the first thing that Rinpoche ever made me memorize. Kepa lobe duna du, dewa duna kemisi, dela chunla chapayi, dewa chenpo tomiyon. Kepa lobe duna du. If you want to be a good Buddhist scholar, you have to suffer. Kepa lobe duna du. Dewa duna kemisi. If you want to feel good, you'll never be a great master. Dewa duna kemisi. Dela chunla chapayi. People who get attached to minor pleasures, dewa chenpo lobe, don't achieve great infinite pleasures. You know, that's a Sakyapandita. Same thing. Okay. And then he compares the Bodhisattva's way of life to medical treatments that hurt at the beginning. And everybody in this room, you know, will end up doing that if you live long enough. Okay. At least going to a dentist or something. I have friends who swore they'd never go to a dentist. Soche Pelba, this is the next verse, okay? Soche Pelba Dindawa, Memba Choki Manzete. This is very cool. I think at this point, well, I want to make sure I'm covering the homework. Let me see. Just so I don't get 25 phone calls at work. The next verse, Master Shantideva, he doesn't want people to get scared, you know? And I think it's very cool how he shifts over tone now. He says, Soche Pelba Dindawa. I've just been describing to you, what I've been just been describing to you is a medical treatment in the everyday world. Memba choki manze te. But that ain't how the ultimate physician works. Okay, this is not how the ultimate physician works. The ultimate physician is the Buddha, right? Choga shindu jambo yi. He uses very, very gentle means. Ne chen pagme sordze. To cure your infinitely terrible disease. Okay? In other words, and we were talking about it up here. People kept coming up to me and saying, it seems a little bit selfish that you keep talking about paradise. You know, you keep talking in terms of if you do this good deed, if you do this good deed, because things are empty, because New York City is empty, it could become a paradise for you. And it's the emptiness of New York City which allows the potential of a Buddha paradise. It's the emptiness. And I keep talking about it in terms of your own paradise, and your own body, and your own angel's body. And where's the bodhicitta, you know? Where's the compassion here? And you gotta catch this, okay? The best thing you can do for other people is to achieve ultimate pleasure yourself. And that's hard for Judeo-Christian guilt-ridden minds, you know? Like, the best thing you can do for other people is to achieve ecstasy yourself. That is the best way to serve other people. You know, you can go and live in Calcutta, you know, and serve lepers and things like that. And that is important and it's noble. But according to Buddhism, the highest service you can provide for others is to reach a high ultimate bliss yourself. Because then you're in a position to teach others. And before that, you're not. And there's an infinite difference between someone teaching it who's been there and someone teaching it who hasn't been there. And everyone smells the difference. You know the difference. You sense the difference. Okay? If Buddha came in here and described how Buddha got to ultimate bliss, it would be a lot more convincing, right? I mean, you could smell that he's talking about something he really saw. And that is the ultimate way to serve others. So unfortunately, the kindest thing you can do for other people is to arrange your own ultimate bliss, okay? And get used to the idea, and don't be embarrassed by it. You know, will there be many nasty, hard, late nights serving other people? Yeah, sure. But the best thing you can do for others is to reach a state of total enlightenment and bliss yourself. And there's no contradiction there. And you don't have to feel guilty about it. Okay? Now, the addendum to that is that the method itself, the path, the Buddhist path, is itself the most pleasant way you can live. So, unfortunately, the best thing you can do for others is to live an ecstatic way of living and get to total ecstasy. And that's your job. And you don't have to feel guilty about it or it's improper somehow. I mean, the highest methods of Buddhist practice happen to be the most pleasant things you can do, physically and mentally. You know, that's just the way it is. And what he's meaning by here when he says the supreme physician acts in gentle ways is that as you progress further and further along the Buddhist path, and as your practice becomes more and more sophisticated, it actually becomes much more pleasant also. So what he's trying to say is, when I'm describing bodhisattvas who reach into their eye socket and rip out their eyeballs, you can bet that for them it's like an orgasm or something. You know? You can bet that for them it's like the most pleasant experience that they could ever have. He's trying to say, don't get into your mind this thing that it's going to be some terrible, horrible thing, you know, and you're going to be grimacing and you're going to, you know, over fight with yourself and, you know, and reach in and do it, you know. It's going to be like, ah, man, take it, you know, and it's going to feel really blissful to do it. And that's the nature of the Buddhist path, because you're collecting constantly more and more good karma. What does that do on a world which is empty? Does it transform in one day? No. Rome wasn't built in a day. Buddha paradise takes time. But what happens is it gradually changes. And you see the gradual changes. And you're aware of the gradual changes, physically and mentally, and environmentally. Your environment, your habitat starts to turn into a Buddha field. Your body starts to turn into an enlightened being's body. And your mind is getting more and more bliss. So the way is blissful. The result is blissful. And the best thing you can do for other people is to go along this blissful way to ultimate bliss. You know, so he's saying, you know, don't think of it as some appendectomy. Okay? Really, he's saying, that's not the way this doctor works. This doctor's treatment happens to be bliss. The goal is bliss. And it's the best thing you can do for other people. And there's no problem with that. And I think that's very uncomfortable for Westerners. You know, you think you got it nailed up to do anything meaningful. You know, it's not like that. You know, and by the way, if you were at that point and they did nail you up, it would just feel blissful. It would feel really good. You know, and that's important. It's important to understand that. I don't think even according to Christian theory that Jesus at that moment was suffering as a human. You know, did he lose his divinity at that moment or something? I don't think you could argue that he wasn't a divine being at that moment. And a divine being shouldn't feel suffering. Okay. Okay. Last point, and we're almost on time this time, which is sort of embarrassing. Let me see. Maybe we can find some Tibetan to put up here. Here we go. Okay. Duying, Kangshik. Ngo Nikur Gyurung Chuying Kangshik Ngo Nikur Gyurung. By the way, the pa after the ta with the yatak changes to wa and then to ya. Ya. And it's a high tone. Ying. Okay. Ying. Yin is a cool word in Tibetan. Yin means a whole bunch of things, like ether, or space, or emptiness, or realm, or it means all these things like that. Xue Ying, Dharma Ying, is a synonym for Ying. It's a synonym for emptiness, and it's an unusual synonym. Okay, you don't see it very often. But Ying is just like, whoo, you know? Like, Ying Qianbuyue means, I'm very intrigued by this. You know, it has all these meanings. The Qiu Ying, Ying means like, just Dharma, whew, okay? it's very hard to translate, okay? It's the whew of the Dharma, okay? Qiu Ying. I don't know how to translate it. It's like, anyway. Isness, or, you know, something sexy like that. Okay. Kangxik is used in a definition where you have two elements. If you're a good translator, you'll say, the definition of natural Buddha nature or innate Buddha nature is A, blah, 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 and B, blah, 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 blah. And it's that A in parentheses and that B in parentheses, okay? In Tibetan, you say Kangxik. You put Kangxik between them. So the first part, thank you, of the definition of the Buddha nature, which is innate, that's the important one. That's the one that gives you the potential for enlightenment. That's the one that you're supposed to think about when you get discouraged and thinking, poor little old me, you know, I'm never going to get to enlightenment because I fell down and bumped my head trying to meditate after 25 years, you know. Ngo Nyiku means Svabhavakaya. It's the essence body of the Buddha. We call it the essence body of the Buddha. It's that part of the Buddha which is his or her emptiness. It's the emptiness of the other three bodies of the Buddha. It's body number four. Body is a little bit deceptive, you know. You kind of think of a Buddha like walking around with four bodies. Like, what's his pants like? I don't know. You know, but it's a misnomer, okay? It means the four parts of a Buddha. I mean, a Buddha has the physical part, which they emanate in planets, like the sound of a wave in California, okay? And then the physical body that they have in their Buddha paradise, which is these beautiful bodies that you see in tankas, and then their omniscience, and then the emptiness of the other three bodies, which is what we call their essence nature, their essence body. So, Ngo Nyiku means essence body. Gyur Rung means, you had it in the definition already of Buddha nature. That which could become, that which could turn into the essence body of a Buddha. Okay? So the definition of the innate Buddha nature is, it is A, emptiness itself. Chö Ying. Okay? A, it's emptiness itself. B, it's something which is going to turn into the essence of a Buddha, meaning the emptiness of a Buddha. Okay? That's the definition. And everybody has that. And bugs have that. And that's why the Buddha wasn't lying when the Buddha said, listen, don't get discouraged. Bugs can get enlightened. Just put forth a little effort, you know? Okay? Last thing. What is it that allows a bug to get enlightened? I mean, Rangshin Nerik, Chö Ying, is the potential. Okay, but potential has to be actualized, right? I mean, it's no good to walk around with potential. We did that for like zillions of years, supposedly. You know, and we're still here, right? It's no good to walk around with potential. There must be some doable program for turning that potential into an enlightened being. You know, there must be some doable method, or else it's pointless. Who cares if my mind is empty? Who cares if I could have seen my mind as omniscience, but I didn't have enough good karma to do it, if there's no doable way to get there? Okay, and that's what this verse is about. It's one of my favorite verses from Shantideva's work, so I'm going to make you memorize it, even though I haven't. Okay. Tsuma, Laso, Jimba, Laang, Dembe, Togmar, Jorwar, Nze, Tela, Komne, Chine, Ni, Rimki, Rangi, Shayang, Tong. Okay.
Soma means vegetables. I like to call it carrots and potatoes. Okay? Soma means vegetables. By the way, this is revealed, the ultimate method for achieving all this stuff. This is the real way to do it. Okay? This is what the Buddha... This is like the last part tonight. This is the most important. This is Buddha telling you how to actualize your Buddha nature. How to turn that potential into reality. You start with vegetables, okay? I like to call it potatoes and carrots, okay? Vegetables. Lasok means etc. Stuff like that. Pencils. Okay, I don't know. What else is easy to give away? Nickels. Okay, lasok. Jimba means to give it away. To give it to someone else. Laang means to that. Just that. Okay? Giving away stuff like a carrot, a potato, a pencil, a nickel. Okay? What? Dembe. Demba means the guide, capital G, which means Buddha. Okay? Demba lame sangyur mpache, kyabu lame nanju mpache. Then, Demba lame genin mpache. Demba means the guide, supreme guide. Togmar means at the beginning, when you're just starting out. Okay? Jorwan Ze means he directed us to do that. Okay? This is very, very important. Okay? And the point is this. And Master Shantideva will repeat this over and over and over again. That the human mind is totally malleable. The human mind is totally plastic. The human mind can be formed into anything you want. With practice, you know, with practice that's intelligent, meaning start small and build up. You can get your mind into any state at all. It will be possible for you to give away your arm and your eyeball, but start with carrots and potatoes, okay? Try to give away a carrot today. Try to give away a potato today, you know, and it's not a joke. It's really not a joke. Make it a practice every day to give away something. Start with something insignificant, you know. Don't be angry at a person who is only mildly irritating. You know, start with the easiest object of patience that you can find. And begin with something small. And it's like exercise, you know. If you've ever had one of those exercise binges, right, where you decide you're tired of being flabby, you know, and you go out, and you see these guys at 6 o'clock, you know, running like 3 miles. You say, well, they can do 3, I'll do 1, you know. And you can run, you run for about, I've tried, it's like not 50 yards. And you're just exhausted, you know. And you're totally falling apart. I mean, even in exercise, it's very foolish to start too big. Or you're going to do yoga, and you try the most difficult thing, and you slip your disc, and then you can't do anything, you know. And it's very typical of a human to do that. He says, start small and be smart about it, and then build up. Okay. And in fact, he clearly states in this section, do not, and that the Buddha said, I prohibit you to give something which you're not ready to give. Very important. You should make a note. Okay. The Buddha himself said, I prohibit you from trying to give something that you're not capable of giving yet. You know, of trying to do some great bodhisattva deed that you're not ready to do yet, that's going to hurt you, or going to depress you, or stop you from practicing in the future. Trying to run a mile the first morning. You know, the Buddha said, I prohibit you from that kind of behavior. You know, I prohibit you from giving away something like that. Until the day that you can do it with pleasure and easily, okay? Don't try. Start with small things and build up. Because the human mind is totally capable of learning anything if you do it right. There will come a day when each person in this room would be capable of giving up their life for the Dharma. But you have to start small and build up slowly. You know, each person in this room will reach that point because you have Buddha nature, okay? You will reach that point. You will evolve into that being. You know, every being in this room will evolve into a higher being. But you have to start with potatoes, okay? De la gomne means once you get used to that, okay? Once you get used to that, de la gomne, Chineni means later on. Chineni means later on. Rimki means, you know, step by step, step by step, step by step. Like Lam Rim means steps to Buddhahood, okay? Step by step. Rangi, your own. Sha, what's sha? Sha means flesh, okay? Your flesh. Yang Dong means you'll even be able to give away your own body, okay? There will come a day when you'll be able to sit at Cooper Square Diner with one of those dull steak knives and strip off some skin and hand it to someone happily, gladly, you know, blissfully. Okay, and don't do it till you're ready. Okay, so we'll do some concluding prayers.